listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and other cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. And so pleased to have you with us. Also very pleased to have Leo Gerard on the line with us, the international president of the United Steelworkers Union. USW.org is the website. President Gerard, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. You wrote this piece, the GOP has an app for that. Tell me about this.
Well, the GOP's got an app for everything.
But this is the Working Families Flexibility Act.
Yeah. That's where they, again, they're masters of using trick language. But this is to do away with overtime and replace it with comp time. And the way that the bill is written is just the way you'd expect it to be written by them. It's got the ability of the management to replace overtime. So if you worked 8 hours, they replace it with 8 hours off. But the problem is that it's, first of all, it does away with the time and a half overtime issue, and that would take a big chunk of money out of working folks' pockets. Then the next piece is that you don't get to take the day off when you need it. You get to take the day off or part of the day off when they tell you to. So theoretically, you could have someone that the boss comes in tonight and says, I need you to stay tonight. So you'd work an overtime shift, but you wouldn't get overtime. You get 8 hours of comp time. But then the boss can say, well, take 4 hours on Thursday and 4 hours on Friday.
Hmm.
You know? So I called it forced flexibility.
So literally the boss could tell you or could say just take 1 hour off each one of these following 8 days or whatever, you'd have no way of planning around it. Workers lose all control of their own schedules with regard to overtime.
Forced flexibility. And the reality of this is, Tom, in real terms, it takes money out of working class people's pockets. Overtime is something that we've had since the 1940s. It came with the 8-hour day. And then they're trying to move to the 12-hour day and the 10-hour day and forced flexibility, as I call it.
Right.
And the thing that's so disgusting and really disappointing is that for some reason, the modern Republican Party seems to have as their agenda weakening the standard of living of middle class and working class folks, pushing everybody down into poverty. I was in a debate with some guy the other night. We're talking about the minimum wage, and the president wants to move it from where it is to $9. I said, let's have a discussion at $10 an hour. $10 an hour at a 40-hour work week, and you work a 4.5-week month, that's $1,800. Who can live in New York City or Chicago or Pittsburgh or any place? Who can live for $1,800 a month if you got kids, even on your own? And yet some of that would be overtime they would take away. That's at a minimum wage of $10, Tom, not $7.25.
Well, I think, President Gerard, that actually, I mean, if you go back to the core of Reaganomics, if you go back to like Russell Kirk's 1951 book, or 52 book, The Conservative Mind, which, you know, William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan all cited as basically the Bible of modern economic theory. What he was calling for essentially in that book was to destroy the middle class, that the middle class, that if a large group of people became wealthy enough that they felt relatively independent of their employers. I mean, what Russell Kirk was predicting in the 1950s, if the trends that were coming out of, you know, at post-World War II continued, unionization and other things, was that eventually women would start demanding their rights, minorities would start demanding their rights, unions would start getting in the way of business, profitability of billionaires, and that even students would start rising up. And when all that happened in the 60s, I mean, all these Republicans went, aha, I told you so, and thus, you know, Reagan, the 1980s Reaganomics. This is This they're trying to take us back to 19th century England, to Dickens' world.
Yeah, and if you put that beside the Lewis Powell memo about the corporate leadership and the already rich and powerful taking control of the political system, you don't have to like it, but you got to admire the determination of the right wing. They don't write a 6-month plan. They don't have an election and say, well, it didn't quite turn out, so let's go back to the drawing board. They've been on this agenda for close to 40 years.
Yeah.
And now they're starting to see that their dreams are coming true, and they're our worst nightmares. And I really think it's, Tom, people like you and other progressive shows that have to educate the public that we can't sustain a democracy in this kind of an environment. I thought Elizabeth Warren was fantastic when she is going to introduce the bill. Now, in reality, it won't pass, but it's going to make a hell of a good debate when she says student loans should get the same interest rate as what the Fed gives to big banks.
Right.
You know, if we can give student loans a 0.25 interest rate instead of a 4.5% or 5% or 6%, we'll help them out. But this is just to make the point that they're prepared to bankroll the big banks at 0.25, but they're not prepared to do that with kids.
Well,
and trying to make an education.
And kids shouldn't even need to. I mean, when Ronald Reagan came into office, and again, this is all Reaganomics, when Ronald Reagan came into office, about 80% of the total cost of college tuition nationwide was paid for by state, federal, local, or governments, or by the colleges themselves. Only 20% was paid by the students. Now that's flipped upside down. 24% is paid by, you know, other agencies, and 76% is paid by students.
Yeah. And if you look at the countries we're told we have to compete with, and certainly in the manufacturing sector, their education system is more of the way it used to be for us.
Yeah.
Their kids go to lifetime learning for workers, upgrading their skills all the time at very little cost, if any cost.
Yeah.
And we've got the opposite. We don't even have apprenticeships anymore in our workplaces.
Yeah. This is are we seeing the final fulfillment of Reaganomics here, President Leo Gerard of the United Steelworkers? And if so,
I think
when does it collapse?
Look, I think if President Obama's 4-year term is going to be the way that it started off in the last 3 months, 4 months, we're going to be in a irrecoverable downward skid. Mm. And I think the only solution to this is hopefully taking back the House, if we're talking about doing it democratically, is taking back the House in 2014. One of my big disappointments, Tom, and I don't mean this to be a criticism, is that we had a movement that sprung out of frustration and the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the Occupy movement is we didn't ask for anything.
Yeah.
We just occupied, and we fizzed out. If that Occupy movement could come back to life, and many people are trying to help it come back to life, people like Van Jones, if we could make that Occupy movement come back to life and stay mobilized, I think we could change the political direction of the country. The reality is the Republicans, as I said, I don't have to like them, but I admire their determination, their stick-to-itiveness. They've got an agenda, and they aren't backing down. They don't give a damn if the country collapses around them. They're going to drive their agenda.
Well, in fact, that would help their agenda.
I don't want they'll help, but I don't want the country to collapse. I want it to succeed. And so that means rebuilding infrastructure, putting people back to work, refocusing on manufacturing. I'm not naive. We're not going to turn it around in 6 weeks or 6 months, maybe in 6 years or 6 or 8 years. But we've got to change the direction. I've been one of the guys that, and I'm proud of myself and my union, about fighting for manufacturing.
Yeah.
But there's an old Chinese saying I heard a long time ago, and I thought, man, that was kind of silly. And then I started thinking about it, and the saying goes like this. Unless you change direction, you will continue in the direction in which you are heading. The direction we are heading is not good for working people. It's not good for the middle class. It's not good for democracy.
Well said. Leo Gerard, President of the United Steelworkers, USW.org. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
He is so right. I want to share some thoughts on Reaganomics with you and where Reagan is still taking this country right after this. So poking around the internet, speaking of Reagan and Reaganomics, in my opinion, what we're seeing and what we're going to see over the next few years is this economy ultimately crashes. I mean, the stock market is up again today. The deficit is down somewhat, the projected deficit. Now the president has till October to figure out what he's going to give the Republicans in exchange for ransom demands. But poking around about Reaganomics and the legacy of it, I found this just extraordinary op-ed. It was written by Robert Bernstein back in 1998. He wrote, in 1986, two engineers worked in Nicaragua to make a positive difference. Both were born in the late 1950s, came from a humanist Jewish background, and both were known for using unicycling to entertain people. One of them is writing this letter. The other is dead. Murdered in cold blood in 1987 by Reagan's Contras while he worked on a small hydropower generator for rural electrification. His name was Benjamin Linder, and he was targeted for assassination by Reagan's people for trying to bring light to the poor. If we must have our national airport named after Reagan, let it stand as a reminder of the shame he brought. War in Central America, the death of the Marines in Lebanon, giving weapons to our enemies in Iran, tax giveaways to the wealthy, the rise of homelessness in America. The United States is an international debtor nation for the first time. He invaded Grenada that same week. The explosion of domestic debt engineered as a way to kill domestic programs, including education and scientific research. He said, it is not the business of government to subsidize idle curiosity. Remember the man who successfully dismantled international family planning programs? The man who brought us James Watt and the destruction of environmental protections? The man who supported the apartheid regime in South Africa? The man who told the Israeli prime minister that he was part of a special film crew at the liberation of the concentration camps, when in fact he never left Hollywood during the war? That was a fabrication invented to cover up his visit to the Nazi cemetery at Bitburg? This is, after all, the man who told us that ketchup is a vegetable to cut school lunch funding. He informed us that trees were the real source of air pollution and that trains were no more efficient, energy efficient than cars. Not out of stupidity, but as a way to cut funds for pollution controls and alternative transportation. Truth and reality was all a game to him. We have named our national airport after the man who fired the hardworking air traffic controllers at all of the nation's airports as his first act of war against the rights of working people to organize for decent wages and working conditions. And what of his obsession with the evil empire? That empire now consists of a collection of nuclear-armed states ruled by organized crime, fear, despair, greed, and hatred, a perfect recipe for further earth-shattering violence. Let us remember Reagan. Remember him for every shameful act he brought upon the world and its people. Signed by Robert Bernstein. Or Stein, I'm not sure how he pronounces it. But well said, Robert. Well said. If we don't start, and by we, I mean all of us in America who are impacted by these policies, these 33 years of Reaganomics, you know, the 1% who are doing better than ever, they're up to over 275%. From where they were when Reagan came into office in terms of income and vastly more than that, well over 500% in terms of wealth. They're speaking out. They're pushing their agenda. They just flipped Michigan to right to work for less state. They've got a financial dictator who just took over Detroit who said, you know, we owe banksters $270 million roughly on derivatives. And we're about $300 million short on paying our employees in the pension funds. So screw the employees, we're going to pay the banksters. City of Detroit. I'm not making this up. These are the kind of decisions. This was Rick Snyder's financial manager, his little dictator for Detroit, the decision he just came down with. These guys are not only shameless, they're proud of what they're doing. Paul Ryan is out there, you know, George Bush, 2006, right after the election. He said, okay, I just got reelected in 2005. I just got reelected in November 2004. I got political capital. I'm going to use it. What was he saying? What was he talking about when he said, I'm going to use my political capital? He was talking about privatizing Social Security, handing it over to Wall Street. He tried, thank God, a few Democrats were successful in blocking him in the Senate, but these guys brag about this. They want to destroy Social Security. They want to destroy Medicare. They consider it communism. This Congress, this John Boehner-run Congress, Nancy Pelosi the other day said, you know, if Boehner was a woman, everybody would say he was the weakest speaker in the history of the United States because he's gotten nothing done. And she's absolutely right. Although the fact of the matter is he doesn't want to get anything done. So you could argue, I suppose, that he's one of the strongest speakers because he has not allowed any progressive legislation to come to the floor for a vote. Only right-wing crank stuff. They've tried to repeal Obamacare 30-some-odd times. The Republicans who control the House of Representatives. This is Reaganomics on steroids. They are still proud of saying that they are in favor of defending the interests of the wealthy and throwing the rest of America, the other 99% of us, under the bus. They're proud of that. They fetishize wealth and power. Oh, Donald Trump, look at that. He, you know, his daddy gave him $400 million. He's only declared bankruptcy, what, once, twice? I don't know, a couple times. I don't, whatever it is, but he's rich, so he must be a good guy, right? I mean, this is the mind-boggling worldview that the Republicans have brought to this, the Reaganomics that Leo Gerard was talking about. And, you know, we've seen unionization go from it was in the neighborhood of 30% in the United States down to 7% in the private workforce now. We're seeing the gutting of the fabric of America. And mark my words, the next bubble that's going to burst, the housing bubble bursting took down the stock market and the rest of the economy. It burst in 2006. The stock market crashed in 2008. The next bubble that's going to burst is going to be the student loan debt bubble. It's going to go in the next year or two, and it'll take us down within 3 or 4 years.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if it wasn't for Reaganomics, there wouldn't even be a student loan bubble because there wouldn't be any indebted students. We didn't have indebted students before Reagan. Speaking the truth, multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. Reaganomics and how it's destroying America. When are we going to end it? You know, I had high hopes. Bill Clinton campaigned. I wrote about this in my book, Threshold. There's actually a whole chapter on it, about how Bill Clinton campaigned in 1992 on what he called the New Covenant. New Deal was already taken. Square Deal was already taken. Covenant sounded kind of cool and religious, and Jerry Falwell was really important, and Ralph Reed back then. So, you know, it reached out. And the New Covenant was basically the New Deal in the Great Society. He campaigned, Bill Clinton campaigned on elevating the little guy, strengthening unions, strengthening workplace protections, raising taxes on rich people back to the point where they were paying just the same taxes as everybody else. They're paying far less than that now. That's what he campaigned on. And a week or two before he took office, I mean, you know, keep in mind you win the election on November, first Tuesday of November. You're sworn into office the first whatever it is, Tuesday maybe, first Monday of January. No, it can't be the first Monday of January. Third, whatever it is. Oh, the third week. So, oh, it's always January 20th. Thank you, Shano. Okay, whatever that, when they amended the Constitution, it's in there. I had to come back and look at the Constitution. But in any case, there's like this two-month gap. And the story that I've read in several sources, and I have no reason to disbelieve, is that Lawrence Summers and Robert Rubin sat Bill and Alan Greenspan sat Bill Clinton down and said, young man, we know you campaigned on being the next FDR, and the people elected you based on that because that's what they want. But you can't do that. And he didn't. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton was a decent president in a lot of regards. I think Dwight Eisenhower would have thought of him as a reasonable president. He governed like a good Republican from the 1950s, which was a hell of a lot better, frankly, than what we would have gotten had George Herbert Walker Bush been reelected. Or had Bob Dole become president of the United States? Oh, my. I mean, can you imagine? Bob Dole makes John McCain look like a moderate In any case, it looks makes him look like a friendly guy. And Bill Clinton made some good Supreme Court nominations, and given that we now live in a constitutional monarchy instead of a democratic republic, that's a really important thing never to forget, that there actually is a difference between Republicans and Democrats, and the main difference is who they put on the Supreme Court, which ultimately rules us. By the way, did you see what Ruth Bader Ginsburg had to say? She's been listening to this show. I'm telling you, she or one of her, I mean, we're only three blocks away from the Supreme Court here. She or one of the people on her staff has got to have been listening to this show, because I've been saying this for years, and it's an uncomfortable thing to say as a progressive and a liberal and a Democrat and an advocate of women's rights, but I believe it's true. And that is, you know, as you know, I can't find anywhere in the Constitution where the Constitution gives the Supreme Court the right to strike down laws. In fact, if anything, I find the opposite. Article 3, Section 2, you can read it yourself. It says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulated by Congress. Congress shall define how the Supreme Court operates and, you know, within what parameters they can operate. But the Supreme Court, since 1803 in the Marbury versus Madison case, has taken onto themselves the power to strike down laws made by Congress and signed by the president, and thus become the most powerful branch of government. And what I've been saying for some long time is that in Roe v. Wade, that the Supreme Court, by making that decision and making it in as detailed a fashion as they did, inventing the three trimesters wasn't invented. There actually are 9 months of pregnancy, but inventing these distinctions between the first, second, and third trimester of pregnancy and coming up with separate, basically, rules for each of these three trimesters within which states can make laws. And that basically you can't outlaw an abortion in the first trimester, and you can easily outlaw an abortion in the third trimester, and it's more difficult in the second trimester, in the middle, and you gotta, you know, all this kind of stuff. That by doing that, what I've been saying for years and years and years is that by doing that, the Supreme Court took that out of the hands of the legislature and stopped the debate that we were having in the United States in 1974 about that topic. I remember that time. I remember being in high school and having a friend. I didn't actually know this woman personally. I knew who she was. She was in my class. Just one day didn't show up anymore. She got a back alley abortion, a coat hanger abortion, a do-it-yourself somehow, and died of sepsis, died of blood poisoning. That was not, you know, you talk to people who were in high school in the 60s and the early 70s, and many of them will tell you that story, that, you know, this was not that uncommon. This was just in a working-class neighborhood in Lansing, Michigan. So the debate was being had, and the rich were all getting abortions left and right. And in fact, I knew some of those at that time girls, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old, who they called them DNCs. It was a very common surgical procedure. Oh, I'm having problems with my menstrual period. I'm going to have a DNC and dilation and something or other, cauterization or something. And it's basically kind of scraping out the womb. Well, if you're pregnant, it'll end a pregnancy, too. And when after Roe v. Wade, all of a sudden there weren't any more DNCs. And they were like really common before then. I remember. So my point, and I'm openly in favor of a woman making those choices, right? So I believe that abortion should be between a woman and her physician, and if she's religious, her pastor or her God or her family, but it should be up to her. Now, that said, because the Supreme Court jumped into this and said, no, we're the Lord gods of this country, We're the monarchy. We're going to make the rules. They aborted the debate. And so because we never had a good debate on the topic in the United States, because there was never a general consensus among we the people that we had actually worked this stuff out, the anti-abortion movement was actually empowered by that decision. And here's what Ruth Bader Ginsburg, herself an advocate of a woman's right to choose, said. Ever since the decision, she said, momentum has been on the abortion opponent's side, fueling a state-by-state campaign that has placed more restrictions on abortion. That was my concern, she said, that the court had given opponents of access to abortion a target to aim at relentlessly. My criticism of Roe is that it seems to have stopped the momentum that was on the side of change. And then she also, and then she goes on to say, and I think that this is a really important point. Roe v. Wade was decided based on privacy, on the Constitution, on Fourth Amendment right, on Fourth Amendment, because the Supreme Court had decided that they could only make laws if it had to do with the Constitution. Back in 1803, so the Supreme Court based this on privacy rather than on women's rights. And this was the beginning of the women's rights movement as well. In 1960 or 61, the first legal birth control was sold in the United States. The first legal hormonal, you know, birth control pill. This, finally something that actually worked. And out of that came the women's movement, the women's rights movement, the women's power movement. And frankly, the abortion issue debate should have been around the rights of women rather than around the Fourth Amendment and what Thomas Jefferson and John Adams thought, who, you know, were not all that fond of the rights of women. And this is exactly what Ginsburg says. She says the ruling was also disappointing to a degree, Ginsburg said, because it was not argued in weighty terms of advancing women's rights. Rather, the Roe opinion, written by Justice Harry Blackmun, a man, centered on the right to privacy and asserted that it extended a woman's decision whether or not to end a pregnancy. I just, you know, when I saw this, she said, she told the students she prefers judicial restraint. She said the court can put its stamp on approval on the side of change and let that change develop in the political process. So what she was saying was the court should have, in Roe v. Wade, still voted in favor of Roe, but done it on a very, very narrow basis and leave all that other stuff to the legislature, to the we the people, to our elected representatives. And I think had that happened, that we would not here be, what, 40 years on, 50 years on? How long has it been since 1973?
It's 40 years, isn't it?
Yeah, count on your fingers.
Yeah.
40 years on, still having this argument. The Supreme Court should not be the arbiter of the law of the land. It should be we, the people. It should be the people themselves, to quote Thomas Jefferson. About this issue, by the way, speaking about this issue, when he was asked why did he oppose Marbury versus Madison, he said, because, you know, my construction of the Constitution is very different from that which you state. I believe that, I'm doing this from memory, I believe that each branch, well, actually, I can't do the rest of it from memory. I don't have the whole thing memorized. But he essentially said each branch should be its own, should determine for itself what the Constitution means. And two of those three branches are elected by the people. And so ultimately, it's in the hands of the people themselves to decide what the Constitution means. And that's really been the case. The Supreme Court has, I mean, the Supreme Court upheld slavery for, you know, half a century. And then decided to knock it down. I mean, it's just, they upheld apartheid in the United States for almost a century. Supreme Court, with this doctrine, has done so much damage. Anyway.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What the Supreme Court also brought us was George W. Bush as President of the United States, maintaining the doctrine of Reaganomics, which is where I started on this rant, and which is what we've got to do something about. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Corky, watching Free Speech TV in Hilton, New York, on the Direct TV satellite TV system. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom. You got the hairs in the back of my neck up.
Uh-oh.
You talk about the 33% of the workforce was unionized.
Right, roughly, yeah.
The greatest point.
I think it was 34%,
actually.
What
everybody fails to mention is that 33% accounted for 85 to 90% of the wages people earned.
Yeah.
Because companies were paying comparable union wages in order that they not become unionized.
That's right. For every, and the rule of thumb was, and still is, for every good union job, there is one job that's not unionized that pays roughly the identical same wages and offers the same benefits. And so as we went from 33 or 34% was my recollection, roughly, which would have been, you double that and you get, what, 68%, almost 70% of America having good wages, and now we're down to 7%, so roughly 14% of America is getting good wages. It's insane.
Now, I'd like to make a point about the American working intellect. Why would you give away the only thing that you have for sale?
Your labor.
You're a businessman. You go to work every day to earn a wage.
Yeah.
Why would you give that away without a contract? You wouldn't buy a house without a contract.
Yeah.
You wouldn't buy a car without a contract.
Well, apparently Republicans in Michigan are willing to do it because Rick Snyder has really good campaign ads or something. I can't, you know, I grew up in Michigan. I can't figure out how the Republicans took control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. It doesn't, you know, it's got to be guns, gays, God. It just doesn't make sense that people would so consistently and completely vote against their own self-interest. Corky, thanks for the call. Elijah in San Saba, Texas. Hey, Elijah, what's up?
Oh, not much, Tom. How are you today?
I'm fine. You have some experience with Reaganomics you wanted to say?
Oh, yeah. Back in 86, I was a contractor. I had some backhoes, dump trucks, and so forth, you know, and was doing a lot of business in Austin with builders. And, you know, old Reagan, he put a lot of money out.
He did, yeah. He borrowed almost $3 trillion and spent it like crazy.
You bet. That money was just a rolling.
And, yeah.
And anyway, I went to work down here. I was contracted out to three of the builders there in Austin. And I'd draw money off of a job, you know, every now and then, and to kind of pay expenses, keep my hands paid. And anyway, they... It went that away for about 3 or 4 months, and I had a lot of money invested in material and stuff that I used on the job and in labor and so forth. And by the way, I paid my operators union scale.
Mm-hmm.
Now I back then I think it was $9 an hour for a union operator. That's what I used.
Yeah, back in the 80s, $9 an hour in the 80s would probably be about $30 an hour today.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I got paid when I was with the union for quite a few years, Local 450, operating engineers.
Yeah.
And anyway, I went in business for myself. Well, I hired a lot of men that weren't union, but I paid them union scale.
Right.
But anyway, to make a long story short, these people, you draw money off of a job, and like I said, I had a lot of money tied up in material and labor. And I went out one morning, and I said, I was working for Nash Phillips Copus, a big builder out of Austin. And I went one morning to go to work, and they had to close down. I mean, they shut everything down.
Hmm.
And I asked one of the men there that I was contracted to. I said, to put it in plain language, I said, what the hell's going on?
Mm-hmm.
He said, oh, they filed bankruptcy. He said, this is bankruptcy.
Yeah, that was big back in the 80s. That was, I think, Carl Icahn took down TWA that way. I mean, this was, you know, the era of mergers and acquisitions, and you would bankrupt companies very often in order to acquire their assets, that sort of thing. So, but it, was that the, you said this is the consequence of Reaganomics. Was that from the Reagan recession, or was that from just some company that was getting bigger by bankrupting a...
No, that was caused from the Reagan recession, if that's what you want to call it.
Yeah.
I call it a big scam.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Excellent point. Elijah, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing the story with us. Doug, in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. I forgot something about Reagan?
Yes, sir. First, I'd like to say I'm honored to speak with you.
Thank you.
One thing that Ronald Reagan and Oliver North did, and I know this for a fact, they brought cocaine into this country to help finance the Contras.
That's the allegation. Congress never really thoroughly investigated that, but that has been alleged. And I think Robert Perry, frankly, has fairly well documented it. But Oliver North, I'm sure, would dispute that.
And I just want to say one more thing, Tom.
Yeah.
I watched the results from the election.
Yeah.
And us African-American, the minority vote, outvoted everybody else by 3%.
Right.
The thing that I would, two things I hate, the Republicans are always going to look bad because they're always attacking Obama. So us in the minority community are looking at the Republicans and say, all you're spewing out is hate, but yet you're going to have to try to reach out to us?
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
trying to reach out with one voice and spew hate at the next.
Yeah. It's not working for them, Doug. And that's why more people voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives than voted for Republicans, 1.5 million more. And the only reason John Boehner is Speaker and not Nancy Pelosi, the only reason Republicans control the House is because with the census of 2000, they were able to gerrymander districts and, you know, basically rig the election. They cooked the books. They rigged the game. Elizabeth Warren was right. She was talking about the economy. Thanks, Doug, for the call. And she's absolutely right on the economy. The banksters are getting bailed out. She's suggesting we bail out our student loan debtors at the same rate. I mean, you know, loan to them at the same rate that we loan to the banksters. Gee, you think that's going to happen? I mean, it's a great idea, but it's just the game is rigged, and we got to unrig it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. You need to know this. It's scandal time in Washington. Boy, this is one of the big ones, by the way. This is going viral around the Muslim world right now. Actually, around the world, period. It's the lead story on BBC's website. Footage purporting to show, I'm quoting from the BBC, a Syrian rebel cutting out and biting the heart of a government soldier, Syrian soldier, has drawn condemnation. Human Rights Watch, others, I mean, you know, whose side? We're on the side of the guy who cuts out the heart of the other guy and eats it? Right. Okay. Well, anyhow, that's Syria. We can discuss Syria, too. There is so much going on right now. And the Republicans want to talk about these so-called scandals. You know, the IRS target Tea Partiers? Well, okay. Fire some people, change the rules if they did. But I don't think that that's the real scandal. I think the real scandal is that they're letting Karl Rove get away with it. The fleecing of the American people is getting swept under the rug. What about Benghazi? In the wake of last week's Benghazi hearings. And, of course, this Friday report about the IRS. Congressional Republicans are going nuts. I mean, they're talking about, let's impeach Obama. He's the worst president since Nixon. I mean, in an appearance earlier today on CBS's This Morning program, California Congressman Darrell Issa, he who cried when he didn't become governor of California, who was in charge of last week's Benghazi hearings as chairman of the House Oversight Committee, he slammed the Obama administration for its supposed connection to the IRS investigation. Listen to this.
This was the targeting of the president's political enemies, effectively, and lies about it during the election year so that it wasn't discovered till afterwards. The Congress has to hold people accountable for it. These were effectively ideological attacks. Whether they were done by partisans who were political appointees or not really doesn't matter. They targeted conservatives.
Well, it doesn't really matter because the guy who was the commissioner of the IRS was appointed by George W. Bush. Maybe. And by the way, have we forgotten about the liberals who the Bush administration's IRS was going after during the 2004 election for giving sermons in churches against the war, not against Bush, but against the war? Anyway, While Fox so-called News is pushing their usual anti-Obamic rhetoric, and the mainstream media coverage is following suit with constant coverage of Washington's latest controversies, Republican leaders, they're hanging out. They're having a good time. Seriously, they're loving this. In particular, because as long as they can keep the spotlight on the Obama administration, the rest of us, the public, the viewing, listening, voting people are going to forget. We have limited attention spans, and we have national ADD, you know, about the very real problems this country faces and the fact that the Republicans are blocking any efforts to fix any of these real problems. I mean, this is the real scandal. The sequestration cuts Meals on Wheels, so tens of thousands of seniors will literally go to bed hungry tonight because Republicans didn't want the wealthiest Americans to pay just a little more in taxes. Here's the real cover-up. The Earth's atmosphere has more carbon in it than at any point in human history, as in the history of the human race. But Congress isn't even considering a special hearing on finding solutions to global climate change. Here's the real abuse of power. Republicans in the Senate have flouted their constitutional obligations by filibustering any and all of the president's judicial and executive branch nominees, creating a backlog in our courts and leaving important agencies without leadership. You want the real abuse of the tax code? The loopholes and the subsidies that have turned the IRS into the welfare program for the richest 1% of Americans, with the rest of us footing the bill. You're not going to hear any of that kind of stuff from Republicans or from the media. Because all the Republicans care about is scoring points against Obama and the administration. And all the media cares about is sensationalizing Washington politics so they can get more eyeballs so they can make more money for their advertisers. Of course, Republicans are enabled by an inept Democratic leadership that reacts to narratives instead of creating them. But the point stands. There are a number of serious problems facing this country right now, all of them caused by conservative policies and 33 years of Reaganomics. But the Republican obsession with winning the talking point war is keeping them off the front pages. Last week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell decided to block the nomination of Tom Perez, President Obama's nominee for Secretary of Labor. And just days after that decision, Senate Republicans also decided to delay a confirmation vote on President Obama's nominee to head the EPA, Gina McCarthy. I mean, there's nothing new about this. They've been doing this since literally the day that President Obama came into office. They've had one strategy, these Republicans in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, and that's to sabotage the Obama presidency by blocking the people he selected to work in his administration and by filibustering any sort of legislation that he supports. Think about his cabinet nominations. The Senate Republicans killed the nomination of Susan Rice to be Secretary of State. She was clearly Obama's first choice. They delayed the nomination of Republican Chuck Hagel to be Secretary of Defense. They delayed the nomination of Republican John Brennan to be CIA director. They delayed the nomination of former banker Jacob Lew for Treasury Secretary. You'd think they'd like those people. And right now, thanks to Republican blocking efforts, there are currently 82 vacancies in federal judgeships around the U.S. One of the most important is four vacancies in the highly influential U.S. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, leaving that court, which is the jumping off point to the Supreme Court and ultimately decides things like labor laws and EPA laws, any federal laws, in the hands of a one-vote Republican majority, which would become a Democratic majority if the Republicans in the Senate just allowed Obama's nominees to be confirmed. They're not going to do it. And then there are the hundreds of bills that Republicans have blocked since Obama took office in 2008. Just last year, they blocked bills to increase the federal minimum wage, bills to put transparency back into politics, bills to set a minimum tax on millionaires and billionaires, bills to prohibit discrimination in the workplace, bills to protect the equal rights of the disabled. The Republicans blocked a bill to ensure that women receive equal pay for equal work. And here's what makes me genuinely crazy. Despite all of this, all these blocked appointments, all the filibustered legislation, President Obama says he still wants to work with the Republicans. He apparently still believes he can get some kind of grand budget bargain with Republicans, despite their absolute refusal to raise taxes. He continually invites Republicans to sit down with him and help him make the decisions that are needed to get our economy turned around. But the Republicans aren't deciding anything. They're just telling him where he can put it. They're bashing his every move. Now they're talking about impeaching him. Mark my words, they're going to try. Earlier this year, despite knowing that it would damage his own party, President Obama proposed a reduction in the cost of living increases for Social Security recipients. He thought, oh, well, if I just do the chain CPI, the Republicans will be nice to me. No, they're not going to be nice to you. Sorry. They have wanted to cut these social safety net programs for years. So what they do when President Obama comes out and says, okay, we'll do the chain CPI, we'll cut Social Security. Michele Bachmann comes out and says he's attacking, it's a shocking attack on seniors. Republicans are calling it draconian cuts to Social Security. Wait a minute. It's a third of what you Republicans wanted. I mean, back in 2005, George Bush tried to privatize Social Security. Republicans wanted to turn the whole thing over to Wall Street. Bottom line here, Republican lawmakers in Washington have only one mission, and that's to obstruct and sabotage the Obama presidency. And he damn well better wake up to this fact soon and start talking back to the American people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Excuse me, talking to the American people, talking back to the Republican Party about what the Republicans are doing. I'll share with you how FDR did that. So here's how Roosevelt, you know, I wrote a book, What Would Jefferson Do? In WWJD, right? Everybody talks about what would Jesus do. I really think that Obama needs to, you know, put a sign on the wall of the Oval Office that says, what would Roosevelt do? Or what would Franklin do? You know, it's he really should. Here's FDR in, I believe this was the election of 1944, but I could be wrong. It might have been 1940, whatever it was. Here's FDR speaking about, in fact, it might have even been 38. Here's FDR speaking about the Republicans.
Let me warn you and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
Right. The doing of them will not cost anybody anything. Because Wall Street will handle it all, right? And it's just this magical thing. 33 years of Reaganomics. It was the first. Yeah, I mean, this the Reagan Revolution turned back the New Deal. The New Deal had turned back the Harding Revolution, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover. And the Reagan Revolution turned back the New Deal, and a lot of us hoped that the Clinton election was going to stop the Reaganomics. It didn't. Slowed it down a little in some ways. Robert Reich was one great labor secretary, for example. But, you know, making substantive changes in the laws, no, the Republicans weren't going to allow that. And many of us hoped that the Obama administration would reverse Reaganomics, but no, we've still got Reaganomics. And I think it's going to take a disaster for us to realize how bad Reaganomics has been for this country. Luke in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Hey, Luke, what's up?
Hi, bro. Excuse me. Hi, Tom. There's two things. One, you referred to Thomas Jefferson a couple times with the pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that He had three copies of The Nature of Things from Lucretius and a little bit of Epicurus, and that may have been where he got the idea to put that wording in there. And the second one, and I want to drop and get my pencil, where's the article by Robert Bernstein? I think I'm the fourth person that's called in.
Sure.
That's why I'm online.
The website is swt.org/Robert/RIT/RAGSHAM And Sue is going to put that in our newsletter tonight. And so if you've, our newsletter's free and we don't share our mailing list with anybody. So if you get our email newsletter, there's one that goes out every day and there are links in it to every major article that I've talked about, every story that I've talked about throughout the show. It's called Sue's Daily Stack. Okay. And it'll also be up on our website tomorrow, I believe. So,
okay, great. Thank you very much.
But the most important thing is, you know, sign up for the newsletter. You'll get it. And but that's the URL. But to thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Patricia in Ettrick, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
I love your show, and we all love your show, and I try to promote Free Speech TV.
But?
And I wanted to talk about the Roe versus Wade thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little question I want to propose to Right to Lifers.
Okay.
If a fertilized egg is a human being and there is a miscarriage, a 2-month miscarriage, a 3-month miscarriage, and it's a person, aren't they required by law to have a proper internment or a memorial service? Or isn't this the law of the land that if you have a human being that is has passed on or is deceased, that you can't just throw it in a ditch or or dump it down the toilet? You have to do something like that, don't you?
Well, this is what you're talking about is fetal personhood, and this is something that Rick Perry and Rick Santorum and a bunch of other Ricks, Rick Scott, are all in favor of. And that is giving the rights of born humans to humans and they're defining humans as all the way back to a fertilized egg, giving those rights to that. And therefore, that would outlaw in vitro fertilization. It would outlaw the morning after pill. It would outlaw, arguably, it would outlaw many forms of birth control. Other than just barrier methods, and maybe even those. I mean, who knows? It's my point wasn't that is right or wrong. I think that we need to be having the debate. I think we need to have the discussion in the United States. And in 1973, when the Supreme Court ruled in Roe v. Wade, what they did was they stopped the debate. And so we did not go through the democratic process with regard to abortion and with regard to the rights of women in our society and the powers of women in our society. And I think that that has, over the long term, harmed the women's rights movement and harmed the pro-choice movement, in my opinion. And that's why and this is what I think happens when the Supreme Court sticks their nose into making laws that should be made by legislatures. But, Patricia, you raise an important point. Thank you for calling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And this is where I was really, you know, it kind of blew my mind to see Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a strong progressive. Come on, say the same thing, basically. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Robert in Hardeeville, Virginia, what can we do? Is that your question, Robert?
Yes. I am a person of limited financial resources and a person of perhaps limited intellect as well. And I would love to know what I as a private citizen can do to get these jerks in Congress to stand up and listen to us of limited resources and intellect. And
sounds to me like your intellect is working just fine.
To do. I belong, and let me just say, I belong to the local Democratic Committee. I am, you know, so I participate. I send emails and I send letters and I send you know, I write, I sign petitions and things of that nature, and nothing ever happens. And it's so frustrating, and it's so anger. I mean, short of violence, what can we do as citizens to make these idiots do what we need them to do instead of
just doing what the rich want them to do? Yeah.
It's just famous.
Yeah, I got it, Robert. I think, first of all, let me honor you and for being a member of your local Democratic Party, for getting involved in the political process, whether it's a Democratic Party, the Republican Party, Green Party, Libertarian, whatever it may be. I mean, I may disagree with it, but I still honor people who jump into the political process. That's a big deal. And that you are, you know, signing petitions and joining in things. The bottom line is, first of all, don't despair. You say nothing's happening. Actually, a lot is happening. There has been a lot of positive change in the United States in the last couple of decades. We are waking up, I think, from the post-traumatic stress disorder trauma that George W. Bush laid on all of us with his massive intelligence failure of September 11th and his response to it and these two wars. I mean, we are a wounded country as a result of Bush and Cheney. And we're starting to wake up from that. And I think even, you know, the response to the Boston bomber was part of waking up from that. We're not going to be cowering in the corner anymore. We're not going to be begging the FBI and the CIA to waterboard people anymore. We're not afraid of due process. We are, you know, in favor of taking on people who are lawbreakers. But beyond that, the reality in American politics, and frankly, politics worldwide, is that nothing has ever happened without movement politics first driving the process. And so my sole suggestion, and Robert, thank you for the call and for your concern. My number one suggestion is get involved. Show up. Get involved with specific movement groups. There are groups, be it moveon.org or movetoamend.org or PDAmerica.org, Progressive Democrats of America. Get involved with one of these movement groups. And there's a bunch of democracyforamerica.com, you know, Howard Dean's organization. There's a bunch of them that are not affiliated with the Democratic Party and that are not affiliated with the Republican. They're not affiliated with any political party. Even Progressive Democrats of America, which I'm on the board of, is not affiliated with the Democratic Party at all in any way. Other than saying our sole mission in life is to push the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction. And so that's why, you know, that is my suggestion, is find a local group or find a national group that has local chapters. And if there isn't one in your town, start one and pick a topic that you really feel passionate about. You know, for example, you said nothing seems to be happening. Over 200 communities in the United States and a couple of states now have passed resolutions saying we need a constitutional amendment saying that money is not speech and corporations aren't people. That's a big deal. That the democracy, the movetoamend.org group has done this almost single-handedly. It's incredible what they've done. I mean, there's some really good stuff being done in this country right now. It doesn't get anywhere near the attention it deserves. But there's some good stuff being done. The opposition of the Keystone XL pipeline, people who are out there putting their bodies on the line, people who are fighting against the drone wars. We did a Conversations of the Great Minds with Medea Benjamin last Friday, where we sat down with her for a half hour and talked about it. You can see it over at conversationswithgreatminds.org. .com. Actually, I think it's both. And, you know, she's got a new book out about drone wars, and it's brilliant. And so I get in, and, you know, probably her organization is, I mean, Code Pink has some men who are members, but it's mostly a women's organization, or it's mostly an organization made up of women. Let me rephrase that. But find an organization that you feel, hey, this is really cool. I'd like, you know, and become a part of it, or create one. Mike in Vail, Arizona, because all of these were created by individuals who said, okay, enough already. I'm going to do something. Mike in Vail, Arizona, what's up?
Thanks. And this is right up my alley here. For all of us that have been paying attention, and there's just a plethora of issues to get involved in, I think we need to begin to prioritize our action steps.
Mm-hmm.
And I would start with the big money in politics front and center. And
yep.
Here's why. It you know, big money means, state and local elections are going to be diluted. It also means, and this is a big thing for me. It basically excludes lay people from running for office, like, you know, for the House of Representatives. Remember, only the controllable are going to receive the big campaign finance donations from all the big groups. And again, what, you know, individual thinking, free thinking person who runs that gauntlet is going to get any of that funding? You know, that Michigan derivative return on investment thing that you talked about earlier, what chance would that have if we had a House that was by and large full of lay people instead of millionaires and their special interests? So
right. We just in the last Congress, for the first time in the history of the United States, passed a threshold where more than half of the members of the House of Representatives are multimillionaires. It used to be that the Senate was the millionaires club, and there are a few people in the Senate who are not millionaires, Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown, for example. But it used to be that the Senate was the millionaires club and the House was where average people went, you know, and now the House increasingly, it's mostly Republicans, although there are not insignificant number of Democrats who are multimillionaires in the House. And you're right. I absolutely agree with you. And that's why I push movetoamend.org so hard on this program. I have nothing personally to do with that organization. I'm not on their board. I don't, benefit in any way from their successes other than as a citizen of the United States. I know the people involved with it. David Cobb is a friend, and he's kind of their main front person, spokesperson these days, doing the good work. They're the ones, in my opinion, who, you know, if we can get a constitutional amendment passed that says money is not speech and corporations are not people, stripping corporations of their personhood and saying money is not speech, that strips billionaires of their power to change public opinion. That not only cleans up politics, that also cleans up business. Because when you take away the personhood of corporations, then you make it possible for us to start regulating companies, to start breaking up predatory companies, to start controlling the banksters, to do all these things that we can't do right now. And that's why the half measures that are being proposed by members of Congress, where they say, well, let's just say for-profit corporations are not people, and let's not even talk about money as speech, or money as speech can be regulated when it has to do with politics but not anything else. I want money to be regulated as speech when it has to do with anything, so that we the people can decide that we don't want a corporation, we don't want Monsanto out there dumping millions of dollars into an election in California about whether or not genetically modified foods should be labeled. You could argue that that has nothing to do with politics. There were no parties involved in it. It was purely Monsanto versus the state of California or the people of California. And yet, I would say that if you were to say corporations are not people and money is not speech, Monsanto could have been blocked. The state of California could have said, sorry, Monsanto, you cannot dump all this money into these ads, scaring people that their food costs are going to go up dramatically if they don't vote to say if they don't vote down this proposed labeling of GMO products. So that's you got it, Mike. You got it. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Anthony in South Bend, Indiana. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I admire you a great deal. This ties in a little bit with a gentleman that just called previously, and that is the Permanent Apportionment Act of 1929, which set the number of representatives in Congress at 435.
Right.
That hasn't changed since then. And what would it do if we increase the number of representatives from 435 to the same proportion that it was in 1913, 100 years ago?
Right.
I think it would be a tremendous...
You would almost triple the size of the House of Representatives.
Right, and I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't either. I think that you make a very good point, Anthony, and I think that, you know, Congress people would be far more responsive to their districts if their districts were smaller. I do think, though, that, A, that's... I mean, that would require an amendment to the Constitution, too, and that's not going to happen until we get money out of politics.
Reapportionment Act of 1929, was that an amendment?
Oh, wait a minute. No, that was a law. You're
okay,
right.
Well, just under the law.
It was just a law. Okay, so Congress could change that, right? I don't know. Shano and I are going to have to dig into this. He's the law school graduate here in the room. We will find out, Anthony, and I'll get back with you. Thank you very much for the call. If it was the Apportionment Act of 1929... then it's a law, and if it's a law, it can be changed with another law. So that's pretty simple. Somehow I got it in my head it was a constitutional amendment. Apparently not. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anthony, excellent point. And thanks for listening to WCPT, by the way. Let's raise the number of representatives. Let's raise the number of people on the Supreme Court, too. FDR tried. Exposing the con in conservative Tom Hartman. Welcome back. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner in the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. And in all probability, that photo will be taken by Ellen Ratner, who's on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. Okay. Well, let's start out with Jay Carney. He said at his briefing today, when asked about Nixon, I can tell you people who make those kinds of comparisons need to check their history, because we have here with one issue, Benghazi, clearly we've been learning more and more, is a political sideshow, a deliberate effort to publicize a tragedy. The president feels very strongly about that. You heard him address it yesterday. However, several of these things will not go away. The AP scandal, Eric Holder, today also, he's the attorney general, had a press conference. He said he recused himself from the decision making, around the AP phone records. He also said that.
Why would he do that?
I don't know. I think it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, unless he had some previous involvement with the agency or with the reporters or with the AP. I mean, you typically, that's why you recuse yourself, because you're already entangled somehow.
Well, he said he had been previously interviewed by the FBI as they looked into a leak that resulted in the AP running a story about a potential bomber from Yemen.
Huh.
So it had to do with AP versus AP, but still, I think he was being extremely careful, let's put it that way.
Yeah, to cover his own butt and not the
right. He also said that he called the leak very serious and said it required an aggressive investigation.
Right.
So you can't leak to the press anymore? I guess.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, apparently you can't leak to the press if you work for the CIA, and that's actually not all that surprising.
Right.
So, and apparently that's what they're trying to investigate. So, I mean, it might be a legitimate investigation. It's just that they went, typically...
Well, they went on a large fishing expedition, and if they wondered why didn't they bring in some of the reporters in question, I mean, which is also whether they... I mean, they would have then gone to court and said whether they... Or they would have gone to jail or whatever reporters do if they don't want... But then you ask somebody to give a deposition.
Right, and surrender their phone records voluntarily.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I have problems with this.
I do too. And, I mean, on the one hand, I want to know more about what happened and why and who and all that stuff. But on the other hand... any time that the federal government is snooping around the Fourth Estate, I think that we all should take notice.
Right. I'm on the American Advisory Board for Reporters Without Borders. We issued also a statement today, and we said that Department of Justice should comply immediately with AP's request for return or destruction of the seized phone records.
As a beginning.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you.
On the IRS scandal, Attorney General Holder said he's going to ask to get an immediate Justice Department investigation into the IRS revelations. Majority Leader Harry Reid said the Republicans were hypocrites because the IRS had targeted the NAACP and Greenpeace before, and the Republicans didn't seem to be upset about that. People are also saying that the Citizens United and other court decisions that happened around 2010 allowing corporations and unions to get 501c4s and to some getting 501c3, which is tax-exempt designation, have contributed to the problem. Nancy Pelosi said there needs to be more clarity in the law and about transparency and disclosure. And the House Ways and Means Committee, that's the Republicans, will have a hearing on Friday.
I'm thinking that it's possible that this IRS thing is going to backfire on the Republicans, that the more stink they make about it, the more likely there's going to be some legislation passed requiring transparency, requiring the IRS to actually make sure that social welfare organizations are doing things like, you know, the Hutter School. You know, they're doing social welfare work, not running ads saying vote for or against the president.
Right. And I think that as there are hearings on this, there will be clarity, because we do know that they're also asking that hearings be held on the Senate side. They will be very different than the House hearings, trust me.
Yeah.
Also, the state director of the Republican National Committee in Florida, he was the state director for Hispanic Outreach. He has become a Democrat. He said there was a culture of intolerance. The Congressional Budget Office today said that the federal budget will be $642 billion in the deficit. That's the smallest since Obama became president in the year that ended this last October, which is the fiscal year 2012. It was $1.1 trillion, so that's really almost half. They said it's because of higher tax revenue and higher payments from Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, because mortgage payments are being met and made.
Right. And the sequestration is playing a role in that or not?
Well, they didn't say. I mean, that is the 10%, so my guess is that obviously pays some, but it has to do really with on the income side.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, it just makes sense. The economy grows, and that's the best way to reduce a budget deficit. Pardon my interrupting.
Right. The Russians, believe it or not, say they arrested a man who was a U.S. employee. I guess he was either third and fourth, in terms of rank at the U.S. Embassy. They said he was really a CIA spy. Not surprising. We do it. They do it. But they released, and it's even on the Internet, Tom, various objects, including cash. One of them gives instructions about how to open a Google account.
You're kidding.
Under like a fictitious name. I got to say, a Google account, like that's secure?
This is what the CIA
is using?
I
don't know about you, but when I write certain things on my Google account, I get ads that relate to that particular thing.
Right, yeah. Google is reading your email, your Gmail or whatever, and they're pretty upfront about it. So the CIA is using Gmail. Fascinating. I guess it's a great ad. You know, it's Google's got to be happy about that.
Right, I'm sure.
There you go. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Always great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, just a quick heads up. This Friday, the 17th, it's going to be Brunch with Bernie on the Road from Plainfield, Vermont. Bernie and I will be coming to you from WGDR, Goddard College Community Radio, 91.1 FM Plainfield, 91.7 FM Hardwick. Plus, Saturday evening, Goddard College presents the Alternative Media Conference, or Saturday all day, actually, featuring keynote speaker yours truly and Ellen Radner. For tickets and information, if you're in Vermont, go to goddard.edu. And plus, tonight on The Big Picture, we're going to be doing Your Take, My Take. And if you want to submit a video question, those always go first. So just, you know, look into your smartphone and ask whatever question you want, record it, and then email the clip to yourtakemytake@gmail.com. Wayne Allen Root, the libertarian commentator, former vice presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party, author of the book The Ultimate Obama Survival Guide, is on the line with us. Wayne, our phone screening software just crashed, and so I need you to turn on your Skype audio, and let's see if we can have this conversation that way. It's going to take me a minute to get the phone stuff back up. Can you say something? We can't hear you. You are apparently muted. Your audio is on your Skype is muted. Can you hear me, Wayne? Say something? No, it's not working. Okay, we're going to have to, I think we're going to have to postpone this conversation with Wayne for a little bit. So, anyway, what can I say? One of the stories that we were talking about earlier, which I thought was a really, really important one, is that in the past 20 years, corporate profits have quadrupled, four times, while the corporate tax percent has dropped by half. The payroll tax paid by workers has doubled. So what's happened is that, and Paul Buchheit is writing about this over at Atlas Shrugged Off Taxes on commondreams.org. He talks about how in Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged, you know, the billionaires said, okay, that's it. We're not going to take it anymore. We're going to leave. We're going to go off with John Galt and start our own little paradise. And we're going to wash our own toilets. And we're going to grow our own crops. And we're going to, well, maybe not. Maybe they took some laborers with them or something. I don't know what they did or how they did it. But... In fact, I'm not sure Ayn Rand knew, but they said, you know, we're gonna not pay taxes and we're not gonna be part of this country. And yet, what has happened is kind of that. I mean, corporations, the corporate profits have quadrupled in the last 20 years. Corporate taxes have dropped by half. Taxes paid by average working people, the payroll tax paid on the first $113,000 of income, have doubled. Corporations basically are letting middle-class workers pay for everything. I mean, this is an example of how bad it's gotten. In the state of Michigan, the Republicans passed this law that said that democracy could be done away with a stroke of the governor's pen. The governor Rick Snyder could decide under this law that a community was no longer capable, literally capable, their children, no longer capable of handling their own finances, and therefore he would dismiss their elected officials. Yes, I know Detroit voted to be a city, and they made themselves in a city, and they incorporated a city, but he could say, no, you're not anymore. Sorry. Your city council has no say. Your mayor is... nothing to do. Go home, eat a peanut butter sandwich, watch some cartoons on TV, do something. You know, he's treating them like children, right? And we're going to put one of my rich buddies in there, Rick Snyder says. He's going to put one of his rich buddies in there, and they're going to decide how Detroit handles its finances. Now, here's an interesting little twist. Oh, first of all, they passed this law a couple of years ago. They pushed it through and got it ratified within a year, which was, immediate effect. And it's laws under Michigan's constitution have to take a year to go into effect. No, they, without the supermajority necessary. So it was an illegal law in the first place. The voters got together and passed a ballot initiative to do away with this law. The people of Michigan agreed with that and struck down the law at the end of last year. And after Rick Snyder and his Republican buddies got reelected to the State House, Senate, and Governor's Mansion with a lot of help from the DeVos family, the billionaires in Michigan, the Amway billionaires. Once they got reelected, what did they do? They created another law, brand new law, just like the one that people struck down, except that this one can't be struck down by initiative because it's got funding associated with it, in a particular way that Michigan Constitution prevents initiatives from striking them down. And he exercised this week, and or actually a couple of weeks ago, and put this guy, Kevin Moore, O-R-R, Kevin Orr, in as the emergency financial manager for the city of Detroit. And Orr has to look at two things. The pension funds for Detroit's retirees are $339 million short. Now, they're not paying retirees right now. They've got enough money to pay retirees right now. But, you know, one of these days they're going to run out of money and they're going to be $339 million short. So the pension fund really needs to have $339 million put into it. Meanwhile, there's a bunch of gamblers on Wall Street who bought bets on real estate in Detroit, derivatives they're called, and the city owes them $377 million. So who do you pay? The billionaire Wall Street bankers or the retired Detroit city employees? Who do you pay? It's going to be a tough one, right? Bankers, city employees. Small number of bankers, $377 million, $339 million to the employees, the retirees. The retirees, by the way, paid into the pensions this money. Where did that $339 million go, you could say? Well, the pension fund was invested in, among other things, things that crashed when the derivatives bubble popped. And it took down everything. It took down the derivatives. It took down the pensions. It took down everything. So basically, the banksters with their derivatives ripped off the pension fund. And now the decision has come down. Kevin Orr, Rick Snyder's little dictator, is going to pay back the banksters $377 million on derivatives rather than put $339 million into the pension fund to make up the money that the pension fund lost from its investments in the stock market when the market crashed. These are the same guys, by the way, who want to take all of our Social Security money and put it in the stock market. And the next time the stock market crashes, they're going to look at us. They're going to say, well, you know, we're going to bail out the banksters. But you guys, Social Security, that's a pension, isn't it? Nah, I don't think we'll bail that out. This is the Republicans' idea of democracy or a republic? Really? And strangely enough, virtually all of the communities that have gotten this you little child treatment by Governor Snyder have been communities of color in Michigan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Not a coincidence, I would submit to you. The Republican Party is not a lot popular there. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and my apologies to Wayne Allen Root, libertarian commentator, former VP nominee of the Libertarian Party, author of the new book, The Ultimate Obama Survival Guide. His website, Root for America, foramerica.com. Wayne, I'm sorry my phone croaked just as we were about to go on the air 20 minutes ago or 15 minutes ago when you were coming on, but you're there now. Do you hear me?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay, Tom?
I hear you just fine.
You know, I wrote something nice about you the other day. Do you know that?
I actually saw it. Yeah, Louise.
We disagree on a lot of issues, maybe on most issues, but you're still a nice guy, and I like you, and I think we've always gotten along, even when we disagreed.
Well, thank
That's
you.
That's the way it's supposed to be, by the way. We're not enemies with each other, you know?
I think so. You know, that I think that people should be able to have civil discourse. Yeah, Louise showed me an article that you'd written where you were basically going after some other liberal journalist or whatever because
it was WGN-TV in Chicago. I've been on their show every time I've ever been in Chicago on book tour. Most of them were political books, by the way, and they always let me on. And this time, they turned me down and they said it's too partisan.
Yeah.
Isn't partisan the definition of politics? Have you ever had a Republican on WGN? Have you ever had a Democrat on? They're all partisan, so yeah. What? You don't turn someone down. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So
well,
I said it.
I can't speak to or for a TV station in Chicago, but Wayne, you wanted to talk about the IRS and this apparent IRS scandal, as it's being referred to as.
Well, here's an area we ought to agree, because
okay.
If this was Nixon or Romney or Bush doing this, I'd be on your side. No president should ever, or no IRS under any president should ever go after anyone for their political views, or you do not have politics in a democracy.
So were you speaking out in 2004 against the Bush administration using the IRS against progressive churches that were having anti-war sermons?
If they did, it's horrible. I don't know anything about it. I've never heard that happened, but if
yeah,
they did,
it did,
I would have been on your side.
Okay. All right.
You cannot allow that on either side, ever.
I agree. But let me take it to the next step. I think that the scandal here that's being ignored is that the president has a PAC now, that, you know, the Obama for America has morphed into one of these 501c4s, rather. Excuse me. He's got one of these groups. The Koch brothers have one of these groups. You know, I mean, Karl Rove has one of these groups. And the IRS code says the law, not the IRS code, but the law that invented the 501c4, the 501c4 is actually that chapter of the law, right? It's identifying that place, that sentence in the law. And what it says is that you must be exclusively a social welfare organization. Now, my wife and I, 30-some years ago, started a community for abused kids in a school up in New Hampshire that's still up there and running. Hunterschool.org is the website. That's a social welfare organization. Mm-hmm. That's a 501c3, actually. It's a tax-exempt organization. And it exclusively does things to benefit, you know, kids with learning disabilities. I don't understand how running an ad that says vote for the president or against the president, vote for Obamacare or against Obamacare, I don't understand how an organization who does that is allowed to operate as a nonprofit organization and conceal the identity of its donors.
Listen, I can't argue about it, you know, with you. It sounds like I'm on your side, but it's a new issue to me because I'm not an FEC expert or an attorney that's an expert on.
Well, this is IRS, and I think this is the real scandal, is that the IRS is not enforcing their own law.
No, the real scandal is Tom, I'm just a guy like you. We may be on different sides of issues, but like, I'm an activist, you know, and I'm someone on the conservative side on most issues, although very moderate on a lot of social issues.
Right.
And I'd be very upset if the IRS came after you and tried to destroy you. And this issue on the national basis right now is not personal to you, Tom, but now it should be, because you know someone who the IRS came after, me.
Okay, tell us about it.
Tens of thousands defending, and the case was thrown out of court. They laughed them out of court, and I won 100% victory. And then 5 days later, new tax audit. And I knew at that moment that this was from the Obama administration. I knew I was being targeted, and now I look vindicated. It's all come home.
Was this just an audit, or were you trying to create a 501c4 organization with the name Tea Party in it?
Let me tell you the story. This was just in January of 2011. I got a strange phone call at my home from a guy who said he was an IRS agent. And when I got the message, I called my accountant and said, the IRS just called me. I'm being audited, me personally. And my accountant said, that's not possible. The IRS doesn't call people. You get a notice in the mail. They never call someone. It's a prank. And next thing I knew, it was the accountant called me back saying it wasn't a prank. He called my office, too. Can you imagine an IRS agent called me at home, and when he didn't get me, he called my accountant at his office.
Wow.
And my accountant said, never in his 30 years in business has he ever heard of anything like this. This cannot be good. These guys are targeting you. Something's wrong. And we know you're in the media day and night against Obama. You got to assume these two are connected, but let's see. Let's give them a fair shot and find out. Well, I hung up the phone. Now, you have to admit, Tom, this is bad. The phone rings again, and it's the accountant. And he says, it's the IRS agent. He says, I just spoke with your accountant. He says, he has your power of attorney, and I'm not to talk to you ever again. But I needed to talk to you just one time, Mr. Root. And I said, really? Why? He said, I just wanted to tell you I have the exact same politics as you, and it's an honor to be auditing you. I fought to get your audit. And I thought, this is really strange and uncomfortable and weird,
yeah,
and stalker-like, and there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
He's playing Columbo, and he's trying to catch me to say something bad. And I said, thank you, and hung up the phone. And before I could hang up, he said, I listen to you on the radio. I go to your website. I'm a huge fan of yours.
Oh, geez.
And I thought, this is bad news. And then they proceeded to, you know, to attack me. Obviously, it all turned out to be untrue that he was a fan of mine, because my accountant called me and said, hire the best tax lawyers in America. These guys are out to destroy you. They're trying to disallow your mortgage deduction, Wayne. And I know this sounds crazy because it's legal, but the guy crossed it out and he won't let you have it. And he says you owe $100,000 to the IRS. He crossed everything out and he's trying to destroy you. So I hired the best lawyer. We went to court. They laughed him out of court, threw the whole case out, and I was fine. And 5 days later, new audit. So, Tom, listen.
And let me ask you a question, Wayne.
Yeah.
When you, that must have cost you a fair amount of money to fight the IRS. Did they reimburse you the cost of defending yourself?
No, of course not. And the same thing could happen to you one day with a Republican president. So you got to be on my side on this one.
Oh, if there is, Wayne, I think every American is strongly with you and the president in his outrage yesterday that if the IRS has gone rogue and if they are playing politics with audits or deciding to grant or not grant nonprofit status, that's criminal behavior.
Right, but the question is, why would they do it without the president's approval? That's the question I have for you.
Yeah,
You're listening to the
answer.
Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I guarantee you, Wayne, if this goes all the way to the White House, that's the end. I mean, you know, that is Nixon. RootForAmerica.com is Wayne's website. Thank you, Wayne. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very exsuccously ugly, the good. Minnesota legislators. Yesterday, the Minnesota Senate voted by a margin of 37-30 to legalize same-sex marriage in that state. Minnesota is the 12th state in the country to allow gay marriage and the first in the Midwest to do so by legislative action. Iowa's Supreme Court legalized it with a 2009 decision. Now that a majority of Americans support marriage equality, for the first time in history, a rapid succession of states have voted to approve same-sex marriage. This year, Rhode Island and Delaware both approved gay marriage bills earlier this month. Good work, Minnesota. Everything always goes a little better, goes better with a little democracy. The bad, Ted Nugent. In his most recent column for WorldNet Daily, the Nudge unveiled his own plan for immigration reform. He wrote, "The Nudge Immigration Plan, NIP, takes 5 years for even illegal immigrants to become Americans. Until then, they should be treated like indentured servants, meaning they have to earn their citizenship. All illegal men in America should be required to work on building the fence to be completed in year one. We would pay the minimum wage, provide food and shelter. Everyone wins." End of quote. Nice. The 17th century called, Ted. They want their labor laws back. And the very, very ugly, the 1%. We all know that the super rich want to go to some wild and cruel lengths to get ahead, but according to The Atlantic and The New York Post, some of our country's richest citizens are sinking to unbelievable new lows to avoid long lines at Disney World. With the help of charter tour companies, wealthy Disney World visitors are hiring disabled guides who can get them exclusive access to handicapped entrances. Apparently, tour companies are defending their exploitation of the handicapped as job creation. Okay, I was joking about that. But in all seriousness, you know, about calling it job creation. But, well, actually, I'm sure that they are. This story is very, very ugly. Amazing. One time, Louise was pregnant with, I think it was our second child. And we were at Disney World with a friend of ours. And the lines were just incredibly long, insanely long. I mean, this was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And his solution was, he says, like, why don't you get a wheelchair and just, you guys can wheel me in the wheelchair. And, or let's put Louise in the wheelchair. And she would have nothing to do with it. I thought, no, we said, no, we're not going to do that. No, ain't going to happen. Sally in Chico, California. Hey, Sally, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV satellite system. What's up?
Hang on just a second. You brought it up a little while ago about the IRS debacle or whatever you want to call it, but I hadn't heard you talk about it earlier. I heard a really good explanation of that on All In with Chris Hayes last night, and I don't know if you heard that, but he pointed out that a lot of that may have come from when Citizens United pretty much opened up the floodgates for anybody to have any kind of organization, put any money, use it for political purposes, whatever.
Yep.
That the IRS then had to do some checking because people were just taking advantage of that.
Well, it wasn't just that they had to do some checking. It was that they were overwhelmed, and that with the Republicans controlling the House of Representatives, there was no way that Obama could get an increase in the IRS budget and get more agents. And so they started saying, okay, we've got to have some kind of filter to know which groups are nakedly political, because if you're nakedly political, you can't get tax-exempt status like that with a 501c3 or 501c4. And so they, you know, for a short period of time, were flagging groups like that had the word Tea Party or Patriot in their name. That's in my opinion, wrong if they're not doing it right across the board. I think they should be looking at every single group and saying, prove to us that you are exclusively, not just primarily, but exclusively a social welfare organization. And they have not been doing that, and they are not doing that, and they should be doing that. So I, to the extent that there's a scandal here that involves the president, I'm far more skeptical of Wayne Root. Of Wayne's argument that, you know, he and anybody who got an audit last year who's a conservative got it because they don't like Obama. I kind of doubt that. And as I said, if that was the case, if Obama had pulled a Nixon, he would deserve to be impeached. But I'm quite sure it's not the case. I can't imagine that President Obama would do that kind of thing. And so anyhow, Sally, thanks for the call. Tom in Minneapolis, or excuse me, John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, add to the conversation about movement politics. The Marriage Equality Act is a good example of movement politics that cut across both Republican and Democratic parties and independents. And I was there yesterday at the Capitol, and it just was a moving experience. And I think a lot of people associate politics with, you know, rather negative kinds of things. But if you could see the look on the faces of people who, gay couples there, and just the emotion, it was just very moving. And it's a good example of progressive politics doing something good for a large segment of the population here. And then I also wanted to say, though, the work isn't done because there's 31 states that have a, you know, a marriage, making marriage between a man and a woman.
Right. Plus DOMA. As,
you know, I forget what that's called, but, you know, that is something that hopefully the Supreme Court will overturn. But, you know, it was just a beautiful experience. There were literally thousands of people that crowded up by the Capitol. I was there and in the rotunda. It was very moving.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, John, I hope that the states get to this before the Supreme Court does. The Defense of Marriage Act, frankly, I think it's unconstitutional, but I don't believe that it is the job of the Supreme Court to decide what is and isn't constitutional. And my concern is that if the Supreme Court gets ahead of the legislative process and legalizes gay marriage nationally, then you're going to have the same thing that we had with Roe v. Wade, and that is the next 40 years you're going to have people on the sidelines saying, wait a minute, we never really had this fight and had an opportunity to have this conversation. And
but this is an issue that, I mean, it really is an example of movement politics.
But you're absolutely right. It absolutely is. And it's
I said to somebody there, I said, an Episcopal priest, I said, you know, it would be wonderful if we could all get together and do this for all of the progressive, types of issues. I mean, just push it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I get very, very discouraged. I think a lot of people do. But, you know, when you see something like that, and then I walked over by the Hubert Humphrey statue, and I mean, look at, you know, another example of good progressive politics was the American with Disabilities Act. I mean, that person was able to push through that legislation at that time, but it is, its impact is around the world.
Yeah, and you know, people think, you know, Hubert Humphrey played a huge role in that, and he did, but really, it was a movement.
Well, there were many people, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it was really movement politics, and you're absolutely right. And that's the perfect answer to the person who called earlier and said, I feel so discouraged, it seems like nothing is happening. And you're absolutely right. We're moving forward, and we're moving forward in many areas in the United States, and this is probably one of the most important. And my prediction is that
it's just very optimistic, and I wish that, you know, my wish for people all around this country is not to lose faith in the process and just to keep at it. Good people will prevail, I think, in the end.
I agree. And I well said, John. Thank you very much for the call. And my personal prediction is that the next group of people who have been oppressed in the United States historically, which is a relatively new group, are going to probably be the next group that you're going to see emerge in a big way over the next 2, 3, 4 years, and it's going to create economic chaos, and it's going to create a a substantial revolution in America, and that's students who are graduating from college with massive amounts of debt. And particularly if the Republicans are successful in having the student loan rate, interest rate, double next month, or the month after next, in July 1st, I think it is, the student rate, student loan rate is going to go from 3% and change to 6% and change. I think it's 3.4 to 6.8, but I could be wrong on that. Shane's nodding his head, so I must be right. So it's going to double on July 1st. And I think that, you know, that I think that a lot of the people who showed up for Tea Party rallies around the country were people who had been screwed by their banks and their mortgages. And they felt like, you know, where can I have my voice be heard? Okay, Tea Party, I'll go out there and I'll yell about this. And then, you know, eventually they realized, and this is why the Tea Party doesn't draw people anymore, they realized that the Tea Party was this astroturf organization that was created 30 years ago by the tobacco companies to you know, as a smoker's rights group. In fact, they even organized a Tea Party in Boston back then, and then, you know, went through several incarnations in the Koch brothers and Dick Armey and Americans for Prosperity and all that kind of stuff. But mark my words, indebted students are going to be the next group to rise up. And if homeowners don't beat them to it, although the economy seems to be getting better for the homeowners, we'll see. 46 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we all have to remind ourselves how the movement for gay rights in the United States, I mean, it's a long way from Stonewall, which was, you know, in my lifetime. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Lonnie in Toby Hanna, Pennsylvania. Excuse me. Hey, Lonnie, what's up?
Hi, how are you? First, I just want to say you're the smartest man on radio.
Well, maybe not, but thank you for the compliment. What's up?
I just wanted to talk to you about your comment on Republican obstruction. Glenn Beck, as silly as he is, was able to get thousands of people to march on the Lincoln Monument.
Right.
So I was wondering, since you're the only one that talks about the Republican obstruction the most, and I was wondering if you could get a march together or movement, since you have the mic.
Well, Glenn Beck had a billionaire behind him in the form of Rupert Murdoch. He had a multi-hundred-million-dollar television network behind him in the form of Fox News. He had the Koch brothers' institutional money and, you know, Freedom Works and whatnot. He had a lot of things lined up to make the kind of thing happen. But I have none of those. That said, and Lonnie, thanks for the call and thanks for the suggestion. Each one of us does, and this is, I think, you know, what we all have to, you know, kind of look ourselves in the mirror and say, what can I do well? What can I do? I don't think the Beck's March on Washington, frankly, did anything other than, you know, perhaps raise his profile for a week or two. It was self-promotion, really, a stunt on his part. I don't think it changed politics in Washington at all. But what I do well is I write books and I do a decent radio and TV show. And there are, but I'm not a person to start an organization. I'm not, you know, that's not my skill set. Tim Carpenter, that's his skill set. You know, David Cobb, that's his skill set. So PD America, Move to Amend, Jim Dean, Howard Dean's brother, he's brilliant with democracyforamerica.com. That's his skill set. Van Jones, he's got a new group. I don't remember the website off the top of my head. But, you know, that's his skill set. So I want to salute those people. But I'm not one of them. Carol in Charleston, New Hampshire. Hey, Carol, what's up?
You know, Tom, you had that guy on there, that Root guy,
yeah.
And I could tell right away he was a right-wing Republican, and I already see it coming on.
Uh-huh.
The right wing is gearing up like they did with Clinton, because I've already seen him on TV already accusing Obama, getting ready to impeach him, the same thing they did with Clinton to get the machine ready to...
They tried to impeach Clinton.
To hit Hillary Clinton at the same time.
Yep. They tried to impeach Bill Clinton over about a dozen or maybe two dozen things. I mean, first it was the you know, Hillary fired somebody in the travel staff in the White House, and then it was... So there was the Travelgate thing, and then there was they wanted to look in it. Well, it started out with Whitewater, this land deal that Bill Clinton lost $30,000 in back 30 years ago, and somehow that became a scandal. And then there was the Rose Law Firm that Hillary used to work for, and they tried to make that into a scandal. And then Vince Foster committed suicide. He was on Bill or Hillary's staff, and they thought, oh yeah, well Bill must have killed him or something. And I mean, you know, it just went on and on and on, and every time they tried to impeach Clinton about it, and finally Clinton made a mistake. He lied about having sex in the Oval Office, and you know, consensual sex between adults, but he lied about it, and boom, they nailed him for lying about it. Hopefully Obama hasn't made any such mistakes that the Republicans can use to impeach him. What astounds me is that when Clinton lied, nobody died. And, you know, now they're saying, well, Obama lied about Benghazi and four people died. Well, no, he didn't lie. And, yes, four people did die. Bush lied and arguably, you know, as many as a million people have died. And certainly, you know, 5, 6, 7 million people displaced, two countries in turmoil, the whole world hating us. I mean, it's absolutely astounding. So, but I agree with you. They are ginning up to attack Obama, and if they can take down Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of State, at the same time, it's a twofer, because then they take down the main presidential candidate for 2016, and they are not going to stop. They are relentless. You are right, Carol. Thank you for the call. Jay in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Things. One, I'm really convinced that the Republicans may, you know, you're talking about the student loans and how students, the next big crash might come from student loans not being paid back.
Yeah.
Well, you know how you also talked about Michigan, the guy that decided to pay the bankers before paying the retirees?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was just thinking that they may have handed the leverage to the students because you're talking to one right now. I just got my graduate degree. I have half of a tenth of a million. Oh, I have a 50. I'm 50K in the hole.
Wow, that's a lot.
To me, that's, well, you know, there's a lot of people with more, but that's our leverage. You know, that's the only leverage that we have is
en masse to say we're not paying. Hell no.
Well, if we don't pay this money back, I don't think that the bankers are gonna, the economy won't collapse. But it's the only leverage that we have.
Yeah. I don't disagree, Jay, and that's why I'm guessing that that's going to be the next big movement. It's going to be a demand for a jubilee, for forgiveness of those loans. Thanks a lot, Jay, for the call. Alina, we have less than a minute left. It's yours.
Good. I have a quick comment. Tom, remember Acorn?
Yeah.
I'm going to wait and see on this whole IRA thing going after the Tea Party.
IRS.
I'm not convinced that it's real.
Yeah, no, I'm not convinced it's real either. And in fact, I think it was probably some low-level functionaries in the IRS trying to do the best job they could with the limited resources that Congress will give them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think there's any there, just like there's no there with Benghazi. But the Republicans are going to do everything they can to try to gin this up and gin up the hysteria and find the little anecdotes that they can point to. Alina, thank you for the call. That they can point to say, aha, you know, look at that. Well, we found a smoking gun. You know, this is the 18-minute gap in the Watergate tape. Right. Coming up tomorrow, it's time to take a stand against corporate servitude. I'll have a conversation with Congressman Alan Grayson about the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and the negative effect it could have on health and safety regulations affecting you, plus the best of the rest, the news, and all that, you know, all that stuff here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active. Go to free-don.com. Tag your it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.